Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 110.
Big sheep. That's Korean, I hope. Do you know why I chose Korean for our 110?
Why?
Because I'm obsessed with Squid Games on Netflix.
Along with the rest of the world.
Oh my God, it's dark. It's dark. But someone's like, you should watch it because everyone's talking about it. And I felt like I wanted to be a part of pop culture.
And have you finished it?
No, I'm almost done. But it's horrifying. Like, it's just I just keep thinking about who created it and who came up with this idea. But it's kind of like Hunger Games, I guess. Hunger Games. What's that other one that's like dystopian, kind of with Shailene Woodley? She was in it. Those movies.
The book series.
No, it's not space. Oh. But it was a book series. I read it first. But, you know, it's kind of all in that vein. So I like that stuff. Maybe that makes me crazy, but maybe that's why we did a show called Slumber.
Yes. Well, hopefully all of our South Korean fans write it and tell us how to pronounce that correctly. Lots going on this week. Beyond Babel is nearly halfway through its relaunch. I don't know what the restart.
Yeah.
We have 8 weeks scheduled of performances. We've just finished the first three. We have five more to go. And we're starting to put in new cast members, which is so exciting.
It is. It's a difficult show to put in new people. It's not like a circus show that has a more variety-esque type of work. So it's a lot of hours for someone to get to the point where they can go into Babel and be good. And most of the time when someone first goes in, their choreo is good and then their emotions are like lagging and then they have to work on the acting. But I'd rather have them do the choreo correctly and then we can always work on the acting. So it's like getting new costumes for them, getting them ready to go in. But the people who are going in this weekend are ready and they're amazing and I'm very excited.
Now, of course, you know, the original cast is something special, but at least I've seen them perform 100+ times. So now starting to see new people do the roles and make their own choices and dance with their own soul and emotion is actually, it's really refreshing for somebody who, like me at least, who's seen it loads of times.
And what's also kind of amazing about the new people going in, a lot of these people were cast way before like COVID happened. So it was in 2019 2019 of October. So almost a year ago, they were cast, they auditioned, they were cast. We started teaching them. They started working. And then, you know, COVID happened. They never had a chance to go in. And now they do. And they want it even more now because, you know, you realize how precious, like, things are and how quickly they cannot be happening. So I think, like, they're just like, we are ready. So I think it's going to be a pretty awesome weekend of shows.
Well, get your tickets. Like anything else, it won't last forever. Only 5 more weeks to go. And frankly, you know, we have such good performers, like everybody keeps stealing them, including Cirque du Soleil in this case.
Yeah, it's annoying. But I guess I'll take it as a compliment. One of our performers, Samuel Moore, he is now in 'Twas the Night Before. That feels like such an awkward title.
I don't think it's called 'Twas the Night Before. I think it was.
Oh, you just wrote down 'Twas the Night.
Oh, maybe that's what it
before.
Is.
Is it 'Twas the Night? 'Twas the Night.
I think they just go by 'Twas. 'Twas. So he's in the Cirque du Soleil show.
It's like not supposed
Twas.
To be circus Christmas, but it's like if you see the show, it's all Christmas.
I think it is supposed to be.
But 'Twas the Night, so it's like more open for all religions.
Anyway, Cirque du Soleil stealing our dancers.
I did not see a menorah.
You know,
yeah,
and you know that show steals some other things.
They
stole
two dancers from us actually.
Oh yeah, another one.
Yeah. Well, three actually. Well, he wasn't really.
It's partially because 'Twas the Night is choreographed by a guy named Ving, who is also very popular in the same style of sort of contemporary hip hop, so to speak.
So, sure, have fun 'Twas the Night, but I love the dancer, so everyone who gets to go see the show will
but I
love
guess
the
that's
dancers.
The first Cirque du Soleil show back in New York City since the pandemic. It's part of this like relaunch. It's a very inexpensive show, like we talked about last time. It's super low budget compared to their other ones. There's like one aerial point,
one set.
There's really no major spectacle style act as far as at least in the version that we saw, and they're planning on playing through this holiday season, which is jam-packed.
Do you remember though what happened when we saw the show?
something we talked about
like
on the podcast.
There was like a fight that broke out in behind the audience behind us. Yeah. And I was like, oh my gosh, should we run out, Josh? And
clearly they didn't have the Christmas spirit.
No. No. Do you think you're going to want to see it again?
Probably not. I think once probably did it. But if all of a sudden there's like a new lineup or a really amazing act or something happens to change my mind,
I'm definitely open to it. Well, I know one person that's in it. Sam told me.
Oh?
He was like, oh, it's the original hotel cart girl. And I was like, Masha?
Oh, yeah.
He's like, I think that's her name. So she's in it. So that's great. Pretty cool. Although we've seen her in Blanc de Blanc. But so she's really good. And I think he told me a few others. There's a new Errol Straps
person.
Duo. Remember it was a duo. There's a new girl who's like the main girl. It's not the hula hoop girl. I think it's a bicycle act.
Oh, I do love a bicycle act.
So that's the insider info I know.
Wow, you're really just spoiling the plot of Twas for our listeners.
I mean, if you know the Twas the Night Before Christmas.
Listen, if you've had enough of Twas the Night Before, you have so much to choose from. Big Apple Circus is now back, apparently. Fourth ownership, nonprofit. That's the first one.
Oh, it's back to... Oh, I was like, it's back to a nonprofit.
No, it was a nonprofit. Yes. So that's...
Paul Binder's nonprofit.
Paul Binder's nonprofit. And then the surgeon...
Neil,
the surgeon.
The spinal surgeon.
Yep, he brought it back to life.
Had a heart of the circus. Perhaps didn't know the brain of the circus, I would say.
Whoa, with those medical puns.
No, like,
In any case, after Neil, Randy Weiner from Remarkable Entertainment, past podcast guest, sort of the controlling party. And now it's been handed off to Nick Wallenda of the famous Wirewalking family.
I am excited to see if Nick can crack the code. I mean, I think he understands the entertainment world and like hustling for gigs and career more than maybe some of the others. So good luck. I just feel like it's been tried in Lincoln Center. It's the same size tent. It's the same location. Tent. Oh, it's the same exact. Oh, but the drawing is just
the
different.
Drawing is like a yellow and blue squarely Cirque du Soleil looking tent, but it is the blue tent with the Big Apple branding on it.
Okay. So it's the same tent. It's the same name, is the same location,
but
most
all
people don't
new
know
acts other than Nick and one it, of the acts.
But every year is pretty much new acts.
Yes, but these acts I really feel like are new to New York. You got a lot of international people and a lot of people I haven't seen, which makes them feel new to me, except for the girl who does swinging trapeze. Her name is Ellie Huber and she was in Slumber in Australia.
She was, and she's a delight. I love Ellie. So
it's worth going to go see Big Apple just to see Ellie perform.
Yeah, but my point is, like, if you're a random person in New York who doesn't follow circus at all, but just like, oh, I like going to the Big Apple Circus, but I've been every year. Oh, it's new acts, amazing, but do I really need to go? You know, like, that's who I, like, how much money do you need to spend to fill up that tent?
I think they're selling tickets that are like over $200 for
which
the
is insane.
Row.
That's more than you would pay for a Hamilton ticket on Todaytix. Like, that's the other thing. Know the market a little bit. Like, I mean, maybe I'm totally wrong. I could be totally wrong, but I just am like, who are buying these like over $200 tickets?
Certainly now.
Right now. I mean, it's after COVID. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, maybe you could have garnered some.
And also, I think
before.
An interesting thing I saw on their website was they have, I think, the normal New York City requirements for being vaccinated and COVID tested. And their audience is children. It's families and children. And that's a real additional burden.
Yes.
If you want to bring kids under 12 to have a negative test. Should absolutely do it. I'm sure it'll be wonderful and easy to do, but it's just an additional barrier that is going to make it difficult to move large quantities.
I would say that we never had that many kids at Babel, but the amount of kids I've seen under 12 is
zero.
Three. No, it's three. Like, and that was two of our friends who were like, we want to come see your show. And one was my godson, because it's really a whole process, you know, to get
so really
tested.
I said zero and you said one real
no three
one.
There
I
was
know, but two
Kobe.
Are our friends don't count, you know.
Yeah, sure. So it was really one. But you know, that just shows that I don't know I'm super super interested to see. And at some point I would like, if we could get the data, it would be so interesting to do a case study on the last year of Big Apple as a nonprofit, and then the Neil era, the Randy Neil era, and then the Nick era. And what they did differently, what they did the same, how much they spent on marketing and everything, and how many tickets were sold.
Yes, somebody please do that.
It'll be so interesting. And also with the world being a bit different, you know, like what's the trend? Where's it going? What, you know, I don't know. It would just be so interesting. But maybe I'm the only person that would find it interesting.
We do have an interview with Neil that we never released that we could put up at some point. I also, for those of you who are friends with Nick Walenda who are listening, I did write Nick asking if he would come on the podcast and talk about it. I would love to have Nick on. I haven't gotten a response yet, but in the past, it has totally worked calling people out on a podcast and asking for our listeners' help. So if you know Nick and you want to hear us interview him and learn about what Big Apple is, tell him to check his inbox for a podcast interview request.
I would love to talk to him. I mean, his family goes back generations in the circus. So I'm so interested to see what happens.
Well, we put it out there. Maybe that one will happen. And, you know, if you've seen Cirque du Soleil and you've seen Big Apple Circus and you've seen it all, there's still more going on in New York City in this November to January time period. There's a brand new show called Empire Circus. Let's not confuse it with the band Empire Circus.
There's a band?
A band, I believe, called Empire Circus. And, of course, the Spiegelworld show called Empire, which was not called Empire Circus. It was just called Empire, but it was a circus.
And if you look up on YouTube the behind the scenes of Empire in New York City, you can see a Josh Avner at like 17.
Yeah, maybe don't Google that.
19. No, but you're so cute in it.
I remember being asked by the interviewer, like, what's the hardest part? And he asked it to me at like 7 a.m. And that morning I had to wake up at like 5:30 or 6 for like a load in of some kind. And I said, waking up is the hardest part. And I just look like an idiot.
Oh my god, waking up, that's when you're like, okay, you're how old? 19. Got it. Yeah, I know. It's but it's at Empire Bookstore, I think.
Exactly. It's
probably
in Dumbo,
where they got the name.
And although I'm honestly quite confused by the overall concept, they're using this IP of Bozo the Clown, which is a famous television clown from the late 1940s through the 1960s, I believe, and David Arquette is attached to it, who's a famous actor. It's going to be immersive, multi-level bookstore, kind of choose your own adventure with your family and kids. Generally speaking, I would be skeptical, I would say, except that it's got a team full of our past podcast guests who are very talented. The director is Lorenzo Pizzoni, who is really an outstanding performer, both an actor, circus performer, director. We love to show humor abuse, and I've worked with him in Spiegelworld. Randy Weiner, who we just mentioned, is producing it. And OG podcast guest Jack Marsh of Circus Flora and Big Apple Circus. So there's a lot of smart people working on it, but it is definitely the least conventional of your circus options in New York City.
I just wonder, like, how many people know Bozo the Clown, who are the ticket buyer? Like, I don't really know who Bozo the Clown. I honestly had to look him up. Like, I was like, I think I know who that is. Like, but I honestly thought it was just like a drawing. And I didn't realize it was like a TV character. But maybe there's like, maybe I'm the minority, you know, maybe a lot of people are like, oh my God, I love Bozo the Clown. I want to go see, like, like if he's a character that people like love, then it's like super fun to go see a, you know, an installation show about that character. Like when Disney was celebrating however Mickey. Many years. Yeah. Mickey, yeah. Like in London, Kay, our crochet artist for Beyond Babel, she did a full installation of crochet with Mickey doing like music. And of course I went because like I'm in love with Mickey, and seeing every room and being like interacting with different art installations of Mickey was like obviously sick. And if people feel like that with Bozo the Clown, then it's like super cool. I don't necessarily know Bozo the Clown though. So it's like, well, I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like it's our parents' generation who are really attached to that kind of that era of IP. I don't know if there's a better word to say than IP, but that character. And it'd be cool to see if they can reinvent it in a modern way and make clowns cool again.
Hashtag make clowns cool again. I wonder if Cyrus will, or our son.
Oh, we're definitely going to bring Cyrus. I've been told it's child appropriate.
He'll be scared? Like, is it going to be a lot of overwhelming lights and everything?
I don't know. He's been in the Babel Theater. He's seen Stars Above. He's seen some overwhelming lights.
Was not afraid of our clown, Adam Kukler. So, like, my nephew was, but it's okay. So, my nephew, Luke, will not be coming to see Empire Circus.
But Cyrus, our son, definitely will be. And, again, maybe you're like, I've seen Big Apple. I've seen Cirque du Soleil. I don't want to do immersive. That's not for me. You still have more things you can see this winter.
But this time you have to go to D.C.
Yes. I think it's just outside Virginia. But Omnium Circus, which is a, I think it's branded as a bold new circus, is doing their first in-person shows in outside of DC. And they're doing it in a similar size tent to Big Apple. I think it's
1700.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're doing shows all the Christmas season featuring Mr. and Mrs. G from Stars Above and our podcast. And they're awesome. And also featuring today's podcast guest, Noe España and his family.
Yeah, I feel like I'm very type A, so I'm very, and like, I'm just like, look at things, and I'm a Libra, right? So I look at things like from both sides, like the positives and the negatives, and all these shows I'm just so excited to see because I'm like just so excited circus and theater and everything is back. And then that, like the other part of me that wants to, like the business brain of me is like, okay, so 1700 seat tent with a new show with an unknown brand name, is that gonna garner 1700 tickets to blank amount of shows? And some days there's three shows a day. Like, I'm glad I'm not selling those tickets and worrying about that, because I know how much stress I feel when we're selling the Babel Theater at 150 seats, you know? So I mean, I can't wait to see it because Otavio and Naomi are also choreographing it. Mm. So I love them. I can't wait to see it. And Noe, talking to Noe,
got me more excited.
Yeah, got me way more excited. And he came up with the story of it.
Oh, lest we forget, Jonathan Lee Iverson, another past podcast guest, is their ringmaster.
Their ringmaster. So, I mean, it's bound to be, you know, entertaining and fun. I know a few acts are in there, which are more like death-defying acts. Does Nick Wallenda consider the High Wire a death-defying act?
What? How could you not consider it that?
Yeah, I guess it. I mean, duh. I guess it is, but it's just such a. It's like a low. It's like one of those death-defying acts. Where you're like,
it moves at a slow speed.
Yeah,
it's a slow speed death-defying.
Slow speed death-defying act versus like Wheel of Death, where you're like, oh, it's over in four minutes, and it's the whole time.
And for those who don't know who Noe is, our guest today, he's a fifth generation circus performer as part of the España family. I actually first ran into the Españas with Streb in New York. That facility, if you've ever flown flying trapeze there, that's actually something he set up. He grew up, you know, in shows, doing Ringling as a kid. He did flying trapeze. He did Wheel of Death. He did Globe of Death. He's produced shows. He's rented tents. He's done
everything. He owns tents.
He builds equipment, props.
He like designs props for Streb and others. I mean, he is such a cool dude. I could have kept talking to him for another hour just because his circus knowledge and his knowledge of all the aspects of circus is so vast. I love talking to like sixth, fifth, fourth generation circus performers. It's just such a different life than what you normally encounter. And it's so cool. Like, I just, the idea of growing up in the circus is so like in Ringling time too, is so cool. So it's a very good interview.
Yeah, I think you're in for a treat. He does give us his advice on what's the best way to live on the road. So I feel like there's some real gems that are practical gems and some real awesome stories about circus life that you don't want to miss.
Yeah, so you guys have five different shows that you can go see. Twas the Night, Big Apple, Omnium, Empire Circus, and Beyond Babel.
Well, Beyond Babel, you have to see because that's our show. Tickets are less expensive than those other shows. It's more intimate theater.
Hey, we were a New York Times Critics Pick and two-time Drama Desk nominated show.
Proven fun.
Proven. I don't know if it's. Yeah. Proven good night out. Worth the money. So, So with all of those show we can't recommend them. We're going to go see them and then we'll tell you what we think. But we can recommend them since we know so many people on each of them. I'm sure it's bound to be good. But if you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hadawaycircus.com. If you can get Nick Wallenda to come on our podcast, you will be extra loved. So anyone out there who knows him, that would be great. And without further ado,
Noe España.
Noe, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I'm thrilled to be chatting with you. Where are we reaching you at the moment?
We are at the moment in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, performing here for a 6 month run here.
And where do you call home?
Home is Florida, Inglewood, Florida. It's by Sarasota, Florida. We've been there since the early 80s. But that's home, which is really, we're only there a very short time because, as you know, in the circus, we travel. I'm a fifth generation performer. So to me, it's always been about, you know, home is where we all are together.
I'd love to hear a little bit about your family, like the family history, like what your parents did, but also what was happening five generations ago.
Yes. Well, I'm a fifth generation. My kids are sixth. My dad was from my mom and my dad's side. They both were performers, multiple talents. My mom was, she used to do low wire act with my uncles. They used to own the circus and tour in Mexico. One of the many acts that she did was the low wire with the umbrella. She also did the, what they call it in Spanish, it's called El Paso. But it's where you walk upside down and you're
The Skywalk is another name for that.
Yeah, it's been mentioned as the Skywalk, where you walk upside down through these loops.
Yeah.
Hang by your toes. Well, she used to do it by her toes and by her heels, which is kind of rare. She used to walk across. She also did a teeter board and trampoline. My dad was hired by my uncles to work in their circus. And that's where they met. That's where they started dating. You know, that's typical in the circus, you know, as you know. And so, yeah, that's where they dated. And then they got married and we had, you know, they had six kids.
You know, where are you in the six?
Well, there's an older brother. And then there's three sisters. And then there's myself and my youngest brother. We were the two terrible ones, the ones that my mom already had no more patience by then, because we were just crazy. The circus was our playground. We used to play around in the riggings, climb up the tents. We were not supposed to, and use it like a slide. And it was just, you know, we were told we were just crazy.
Man. Did you do group acts with your siblings or anything when you were younger?
Well, when I was young, my oldest brother with my two older sisters, they used to do rollerball acts. They did other acrobatic floor acts. And then sometime in the mid 70s or early 70s, they started doing flying trapeze. That was their flying trapeze act, in our family. I was already practicing. I was only 8 years old, but I was already throwing doubles and flips off the pedestals and things like that. It wasn't until 1980, we joined Circus Vargas. Well, we came to the States back in 77. Trampoline was my act when I was a kid in Mexico with my uncles, and whatever there was a trampoline that was, you know, become my act. But it wasn't until we came into the States in 1977 that we, in the 80s, we joined Circus Vargas, a touring show in California. And we started finally, my youngest brother was older. My other sister was getting better in the trapeze. So then we formed two flying trapeze troops. So ring one and ring three was, you know, ring one was my oldest brother with my two sisters. And ring three was myself, my brother, and my sister. And the catchers, we had to hire. We always had to hire the catchers.
I want to hear more about that. Before we get into it, well, you said previously that your parents were running a circus in Mexico. What was the name of that that circus? And out of curiosity, the generations preceding, all Mexican circus family, or what part of the world did they come from?
Well, it's obviously because of my dad's side, we understand we come from Spain. Like we, you know, obviously the name says it, España, because they said people back in those years when they leave Spain, they wanted to be known as from Spain. So it was like Fernando de España, Fernando from Spain. So our ancestors come from Spain, and my dad's side, they come from Spain and went to, I believe they were a short time in South America and then came to Mexico. And then from my mom's side, there is some conversations with my uncles that they, you know, I don't think they used to keep track of descendants back then, but I think there was a part of my mom's, like their great granddad, they think they came, because Mexico is also a big where people immigrated a lot from China, from everywhere. So I think they said that from my mom's side, there was some Arabic, you know, back, like, I don't know, I need to do that ancestry.com because it's just, you know, too much mystery there. But yes, there was their circus, my uncle's circus. They had several shows. One of their first one was called Circo Flama, which means flame circus.
Cool.
They had another one. It was called Circo Mayar. Mayar because they used to be acrobatics. They used to do four brothers and my mom was the only sister. They did floor acrobatics. And they were called the Five Mayars, so they call it Circo Mayar. And then the last circuses that I remember, I was already born and used to be in that show whenever. We used to go to other circuses to perform, but we always come back with my uncles. It was called Circo Crony with the Y.
Mm.
Circo Crony.
Does that mean, is it a name or does that mean anything?
You know what? Krone, it's a very big famous circus in Germany.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, but with an E at the end, right?
With an E. But I think they just like let's be Circo Krone. that's all I can think of because I don't think there's any relation to last names or anything.
Oh, okay, got it. All right, so jumping back to being in California with Circus Vargas and doing the trapeze act with your siblings. Was there any point when you were, you know, growing up in this time period where you were like, I don't want to do circus. I want to go work for NASA or go, I don't know, do a totally different kind of thing? Or was it always just obvious to you that that's where you wanted to be?
You know, I think for circus born kids, we think that's the only world. I'll tell you a funny story because I do remember like circus was, we feel like that's like the whole world rolls around us. You know, we're so, like when this moment we arrive in a town, that's like our street and that's our, you know, we feel like we own every place we go. So no, it was very natural to me to just knowing, especially seeing my older siblings performing and getting applauded and getting always complimented. And, you know, you want to be part of that. To me, it was just natural to be, as I got older, maybe in my teens, I used to like video and photograph, you know, and I if it was anything I was going to do different, it was probably going to be something in the filmmaking or because I really like that. Mm. But not really. I just, you know, it was circus was just my world. Because we spent the 3 years we spent in Circus Vargas, right after that, we went to Ringling Brothers. And that's where I realized that there was a world out there because see in Circus Vargas and also back in those years, a lot of the circus people were like circus born people. You didn't really, you know a lot of the people outside the circus. Ringling Brothers, they used to hire 16 dancers and 18 clowns that came out of high school. And I have to admit this, it was through them, like making friends through them. And they were so excited about going to a new city and we're going to be in this famous arena called Madison Square Garden. And it was through them that I actually started appreciating what I was part of because, they value more, you know, the whole concept of traveling and being in different places and meeting a lot of people. To me, that was just very common, very normal. Mm. It was fun. It wasn't nice or anything, but it wasn't as exciting once you knew how important those things were, you know, as you meet people from outside the circus.
So I think, you know, I want to ask you also about the other disciplines that you were doing. I don't know if you start doing it at this point, but one thing we talked about offline was Wheel of Death. And I saw on your resume, you also did Globe of Death or Wheel of Destiny, depending on how you want to say the dark version or the exciting version, Destiny or Death. But, you know, I think we've had a lot of people on who have gone to circus school, and there's a lot of different kinds of things you can learn at circus school. Neither of those things are a Globe of Death or Wheel of Death. They're much more normal fabric, trapeze, juggling. Although, of course, juggling, you don't need to go to school for it all. But how would you give a little bit of insight into the process of how you start to work on either of those disciplines? How do you go from nothing to, flipping 40 feet up or, you know, with five motorcycles spinning around you?
Sure. Well, like I said, you know, initially for me, trampling was my first physical learn, you know, anything that I was learning in acrobatics. That gives you, doing trampling gives you a lot of experience to flip. And so that, and in circus, typically people who learn trapeze, they learn trampoline. You have to, it's shoot, you have to, because it teaches you the flipping and the spinning and, you know, where you are in the air. So that was pretty much like going into trapeze. It was sort of a, just another step. And now you're dealing with heights and, but there's all these elements of like, you know, sort of encountering fear and avoiding thinking of fear when you're doing this stuff, because it, you know, fear can actually become more dangerous sometimes because you're too worried about being scared that you don't think about what you have to do. So that I learned a lot of the whole physical abilities and fear, you know, fear control, that I learned it already in the flying trapeze. When I went on to try the Wheel of Death with my younger brother, it was an act that we said, oh, you know, we should try that. We saw some other people did it, and we like, I like to know what that's like. So, you know, I started designing a wheel. We were initially going to build it all ourselves because we also used to love doing that kind of stuff. We end up having somebody build it. And the funny thing actually about that, and maybe this answers your question. This is in 1986. We were leaving Ringling Brothers. And as we were trying to book ourselves to other shows, you know, all we had to offer was flying trapeze. And they've said, well, hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm so sorry.
No worries.
I was just asking, no way. We talked a little bit about his family history, and he's got six siblings, and they were doing flying trap. And I was asking him how he also started learning Wheel of Death and Globe of Death.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Up to now.
I'm glad I didn't miss the whole that. I was so interested in knowing about that. So I'm glad I didn't miss this part.
Well, here's the thing. So what happened was, and it, you know, it's something, I mean, obviously you have to want to really do it. Like you have to have that, oh, I want to do that. But we were leaving Ringling, because we spent 4 years, 83 to 86, performing two rings of flying trapeze. That's all the acts we had. And as we were leaving, we were booking, you know, ourselves out of that show. We were told, oh, no, we need more acts. You can't have just one act. So it was like, okay, so we can do the Wheel of Death. We already want to do that. So that we already had a contract before we even had an act, to be honest. So my brother and I, we just started practicing. We were still touring. We got the wheel and we would set it up outside and started going on it. And it was something, like I said, I think it becomes sort of something that you want to do. Like, you know how it is when you want something, you get it. You know, that's, call it whatever you want. Some people say the power of intention, but it does happen that way. But also having the opportunity, it's always the next step. And for us, that's what it was. And I love the wheel. What I loved about the wheel, because, you know, flying trapeze is a group act, and you're pretty much in the pedestal. You do what you do. You do the trick. You come back, and then it's the next person. I feel like people are only paying attention to the tricks and when you're flying up in the air. But in the wheel, it's like they're always watching you because you're about to fall anytime. So now you have a little chance to even perform and act it up a little more if you like. So it is a lot of fun to entertain the audience and hear them react and hear them scream. So that's part of the reason why these kind of acts also, I think, you know, they're very attracting to some of the performers. Like they like, you know, they like the feedback you get from that.
I still remember the first time I saw Wheel of Death because it was so exciting. And you know, the jump rope bit, yeah, where you have, and then there's the trip. And I was like, oh my God. And Josh was like, you know, who had seen it so many times, was like, you know, laughing. But no, it's the best.
Know that those things actually happen by accident. And then when you hear the reaction, like, oh, I should do that again. You know, I've come to the conclusion over these many years of performing, and this isn't all say, you know, it's not what you do, it's how you do it and all that, but it is so true. You know, it has become for me more important, because flying trapeze was a challenge. Like, I want to do this trick. I want to catch the triple. I want to, you know, it's a personal challenge that you dealt with. And then, you know, you just almost maybe like a gymnast, or, you know, even though there's no judges, we're still like, we're like our own judges. Oh, I want to be able to do that. Nowadays, and that's what I try to teach my kids now, is, you know, really our responsibility as entertainers is to entertain the audience. Like, that's the new art, is finding out ways how to attract the audience attention in that moment, in those 5 minutes that you have. Come up with my son does the Diablos, and he does one of the easiest trick, but he does it in such a way and in such a moment in the music, that's when the audience mostly react. You know, so but you gotta keep an eye on those things, because we gotta study the audience, because we're there to entertain them, and we need to figure out those ways. There's obviously, you know, difficulty needs to be added and all that. You know, there's gotta be, you know, talent as well. But I think now more of the part of that talent is to understand how the formula to give the audience that experience. And I think that's becoming more and more, for me at least, I understand a lot more nowadays.
You know, one thing I'm just curious about Wheel of Death in particular, does it feel like how it looks, I guess is the question. Like, or does it feel as somebody who does it quite different of an experience?
It's dangerous. That's like, I'll say this, you know, danger is real and fear is a choice. Because what happens is, like when I started doing the wheel the first time, I tell you, I'll be honest, you know, even when I worked on heights, I felt the fear, and you start to freeze up. And so that's the first thing that you have to, you know, get used to, because otherwise you're going to end up really messing up just because the fear gets in the way. I'll give you an example. I invented this. I haven't seen it. I see now people are doing forward flips on the outside, but way before anybody was doing that, I came up with this idea to flip over on the outside of the wheel, to flip over fire. I created this grill that it was about, I don't know, 4 feet high, propane gas. I designed and built that stuff. And then it was just like fire shooting out. And the whole idea was that I would get enough momentum. I had to put a little mat, and I had to jump over that and land on my back and roll, right? Well, the first time, you know, I couldn't put a safety. I couldn't do anything. I had to just go for it. The first time I was going to try that without the fire, obviously, I realized that I had to jump when the wheel wasn't there yet. Like I was about to leap and I said, well, where is the wheel? But, you know, I remember the wheel still turning. And as you land now, so when I was about to jump, I was looking straight down into the floor, you know, and then as long as my brother keep that rotation going, then I was going to fall in the wheel. So I had to control that fear, that split second fear factor that kicks in to like really do this. You know, you gotta have it on you, and you really want to do it, really want to do it. Otherwise, you're just gonna get off and go, that's it, I don't want to do this again. So it is dangerous. It is, there's things you have to get over. You know, your instincts sometimes kick in, and you know, you start to do things you're not supposed to. It's just something you have to control a lot.
When you're originally learning the Wheel of Death, do you start by going on the inside and getting really comfortable with that, and then you move to the outside?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
And then when you're trying to learn how to do a flip on the wheel, do you just, like you said, go for it?
You know, you got to have some knowledge, some physical understanding of your body. You know, I've did triple somersaults. I even tried the quadruple at one point. I did, you know, I was very aware of my body's movements and so that was very helpful. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't help just to be crazy or just too daring. Like, I'm just going to do it and see what happens. I mean, you have, there's some calculations that need to happen.
This is so scary.
That's my attitude.
So
I'm
going to
just do it and see what happens.
Oh my God.
And then the motorcycles, as you know, yeah, it's, that's a different act. Another act that we said, my brother and I, like, yeah, let's try it. I want to learn it. Why not? You know, We had a few, I call them, some people call them crash. I call it learning experience, because every time you make a mistake, you crash, you learn, oh, I shouldn't do that again. But we did, and we were in Ringling Brothers. And, you know, one thing we, like, obviously we didn't invent flying trapeze or the wheel of death or the globe of death. One thing that we always try doing is innovate a little bit, like bring that and put some ideas. And like, for instance, the Globe of Death, we added the black light. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was ever been done. This is back in 90, what year was that? Maybe 93. And it was just like, oh, you know what? What if we added black light? Can we do even, is that even possible? So we were in there just trying to find out what the fabric that glows and putting some lights and then see what, and turns out it worked. And then I never forget, Madison Square Garden one time, it was packed. 25,000 people. And we even with the, you know, because the black light, it would be added while we, all three of us were in there doing the loop as you go over the top. And then the lights would go off, and then the people were already screaming because you hear the bikes going, ah. Then the lights go off, and now we're in the, you know, all you see is zooming neon lights. People, I could hear them inside my, people. It was like a stadium, you know, like you stuff you hear on baseball, I guess. But it was, you know, those are the things like, oh, right, you know, we did it. You know, we came up with this idea. It works. The people love it. And now we got to do it every day.
Okay, similar question to what Lindsay asked. And I don't, is this truth or fiction? Because I don't know. Somebody who I spoke to years ago who was did not do Club of Death, they were just telling me like they knew that the way you learn is you learn with bicycles. And when you get good doing a bicycle, then you use a motorbike. Is that true or false?
Some people that I know have done it that way. Yes, it is truth that you can go in there with the bicycle. I actually, one of my nephews was doing that for a while. But no, I didn't learn with it. And you know, it's probably a good idea because it gives you a sense of motion. Because it's a, I remember the first time I tried the motorcycle in there, I kept falling, but not mainly because my instinct was trying to do this. Like I was trying to strain it up. And it was very hard to tell my brain, this is okay. If you go in sideways, it's a, you know, it was, I keep, as I took off, I would go like this, but it was just my instinct reacting. I drove a motorcycle in the streets and I I'm usually standing straight, but now you were sideways. So it just took a little, you know, it's a mind control thing and fear control as well. I seen some people going in there with bicycles. So yes, it's truth.
So you and your brother who decided to learn the Wheel of Death and Globe of Death, what were your other siblings doing? Were they like, no, thank you, we're going to stick to flying trapeze?
Well, we were, the funny thing is that my brother and I were the last ones. It was a family of six. We had my oldest brother and my three sisters, and then myself and my youngest brother. And we were the last ones. I was telling earlier that we were in, when we were kids, like when we were, you know, 6 and 7 years old, my mom was always worried because we were always out up on the trapeze with no net. We used to, when nobody leaves the tent, we would go up there and climb up there. And yeah, you know, just looking down. We used to climb up the tents and use them like a slide. And then we got caught doing that. We got a beating for that, obviously, because we were going to get killed, you know. But we were just very anxious to this kind of thrill. And you know, growing up in the circus, I don't know, maybe even before I can remember, I saw somebody hanging up there, probably my mom. And that was normal to me. So it just, you know, it's not, you know, we don't think it's dangerous, which it is. But yeah, no, it came pretty natural to us to go from doing flying, you know, like trampoline, flying trapeze. And we did, you know, you're familiar with the incline motorcycle, where it's a motorcycle on the high wire. That's another act that we added some years later. Kiss, they were doing an opening concert for, it was called Psycho Circus. It was a thing in Los Angeles in 98 or 99, I can't remember. And we were already doing Motorcycle Globe and said, yeah, can you guys do the incline motorcycle? We need a motorcycle to go over the audience. And then Paul Simmons wants to ride it. And I said, sure, we can get a motorcycle. So we went out there and we got ourselves a rigging and we did it, you know? It was like 60 feet high, you know, going on the stadium and stuff. But it is, you know, the heights does change. After 20, 30 feet, it starts to feel different. But again, it's probably part, it's in our wiring system, you know. But yes, that's our daredevil life, right? That one side of our life.
So when I moved to New York City, maybe in 2008 or 2009, the first thing I did when I got here was like, where is the place to train circus in New York City? And at the time, the obvious choice was Streb, which when you walk in was the Streb España, you know, Trapeze Academy. I don't remember the exact title of it, but how did you get involved with Elizabeth Streb and that dance company?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, we're always open for anything, any opportunities. We ran into Elizabeth Streb and I think it was 98. And I was very interested to see something they were, you know, it related to a lot of stuff that we do with rigging when it comes to the Wheel of Death. And I saw that they were having these constructions where the guys were climbing up. And I was really, really like, wow, But it wasn't a circus. It was a dance company, but it was really not a dance company. They were just doing a lot of crazy stuff, like crazy, amazing stuff. I had a friend who lived in Louisville, Kentucky. His name is James Carter. And we were just passing by. We visit them. And Elizabeth Strip was coming with the show to Louisville, Kentucky. But we weren't going to be. We were just driving by. And I said to Jim, my friend, could you go to that show and meet her? I said, I'm interested to see what is it they're doing. You know, they're not a circus, but then they have all this. So any story short, he went over there. I gave Jim my cassette player, my VHS at the time. I said, here's a, we just produced a show called Extreme Boulevard. And it was basically the idea of it. It was a contemporary looking show where it was a street-like, and the whole idea was that it was just extreme action. We took out the most dangerous and thrill acts of the circus and put it all in one show. We had the globe, the motorcycle, and non-circus, more like rock and whatnot. Anyway, he gave her that tape, and within a week or so, she reaches me. Oh my God, we got to do something together. And that led to conversations. She wanted to explore more ways about like what are the things she could do. So we provided a bungee. They didn't have bungees at the time. We had bungee act trapeze. So we provided that, teach the kid, team how to do it. And then they kind of did their own choreography. And then another year she wanted something like the wheel. So I designed a small version of the Wheel of Death that she could do in small theaters. And when she asked me about that, it was like, so I want to do something in the ways, but I said, well, first of all, I know you have a big team. How many people you want to put in that wheel? He's like, maybe like 8. And I said, okay. So I had to I designed it, had it built to be, beefed up so that it was going
to
hold.
This is the one that's people. It's got one wheel and it kind of goes to a triangular point at the other
yes.
end. And I've seen the act with 8 people.
They jump. I gave her, there's all these things, I just give her ideas and designs, and then she kind of makes them do all that stuff. It was a hard one because the axle was my biggest issue because it had to rotate in itself. You can't have the axle running across because you were going to trip. Anyway, it's very technical. I remember struggling to design that. But anyway, she had that. And then I think I jumped because actually was the flying trapeze was the next concept. She bought, they were renting the studio and they wanted to put a flying trapeze in there. I says, I flew from Chicago. We were performing out of Six Flags, I think, at the time. And they were like, I flew in for one day. And it was just a big empty warehouse. And somebody just moved out because there was like garbage everywhere. And he was like, can you do trapeze in here? I said, a very specific trapeze, yes, because they didn't have the height. So I came up with the first idea there for the, instead of a net, was a sponge, I had a friend in the circus that used to jump from like 45 feet into a sponge. And he helped me, Scott Aswood, he helped me design that bag, but his was only like 12x8. And this had to be like 42x12. It's a huge undertake to make that sponge. So I got into designing that. And then also we did some classes. So, I think to answer your question, that collaboration with Elizabeth Strip was just very natural as well, because she's so much into extreme action and even dangerous moves. And we're in that field as well, when it comes to our part in the circus.
Sort of two questions off of that. One, I have used that trapeze rig and I've fallen into their airbag or whatever it is.
It's the airbag now, right?
Yeah, I experienced both, I believe. Okay. Maybe like in 2000, hopefully 2009 back then was the sponge. I hope that's what it was. But the ceiling height is extra low. So I guess this is a broader question. When you go from venue to venue and you have an act like flying trapeze, and the ceiling height changes or the width of the space changes or the distance to the net or the bag changes, what kind of like mathematical calculations do you need to make to know that all of the swings will align and that the things are the right length and the floor is far enough away? Is that just experience and being able to say like, that's that, that, excuse me, is that just experience and that doesn't look right? Or that's, let me get out my calculator and figure out like exactly the dimensions.
A little bit of both, but I think it's, you know, when I tour with my flying, like when we were performing those many years and wriggling with the flying trapeze, it was, they were rigging their net. They always set it up. All the arenas are big. They were stay pretty consistent. The height that changed was from the top of the trapeze up. Mm. Like I give you an example, we worked in arenas that were like 40 feet, 50 feet. So then you have so much cable up there and then you feel a little bit of bounce. We performed one time in a Superdome, which is 300 feet. Now there was like, you know, 200 and something feet of cable. And I remember swinging on that thing and it was like, oh my God, the whole, I mean, they tension it, but it was still moving. So I had to adapt a little bit of my timings to do the right timing to catch the tricks, right? When I started touring and it was my rigging, yes, the net always has to be, you need at least those 9 feet and, you know, net so that when you land on it, you don't hit the concrete. So no, that cannot change. Well, that was one of the reasons why it's trapped. We only had 4 feet to play with. And that's the only option we had. There was the other option was to dig into the ground, but that was going to cost a fortune. But no, the net has to be at the height. The trapeze, they're always within 30 to 32 feet. If you start to go higher, funny enough, the body feels different. For me, it was like, if I ever hang the trapeze at 34 feet, now you got 2 more feet away from the net, it felt different, you know, and you really have to stick to your like timings because that can throw you off completely, you know, flying into the catcher or just, you know, missing because you're too short. You know, if you've done trapeze, you understand like the pike. And if you break too late, now you're going to be too short. If you break too early, you're going to kiss the catcher. You know, there's all that variation of things can happen. But to answer more of the question is like, it's experience. And there's a little bit of calculation. We worked in different buildings where we had to make some adjustments. I never adjust my length, the length of my trapeze bar or my catch bar. You know, that had to be the same, but the height, yeah. And then the difference when you're working on a big arena, it feels different, the rigging. I'll tell you something. I stopped doing trapeze many years ago and I miss it because it was such a joy to do trapeze and I really got a lot of joy out of it, but I don't miss it because the trapeze, when you're touring with flying trapeze, it's complicated. You got so many guy out, so many cables out there and so many places you need to attach into the ceiling. So I mean, a lot, you know, when you work with companies like Ringley, where they do all your rigging, it's a lot easier. But when you do your own, you got to figure it out yourself. You got to find out the inserts on the floor. You got to find out where to hang. And so it's
tough. It doesn't sound like you're making it easy on yourself, particularly with having to move Wheel of Death or Globe of Death. Those things seem like big things to pack up and unpack, even if you're not hanging.
I don't know what. Why? That's why I'm not teaching my kids those acts. There's too much hassle with all that.
Diablo is not so bad.
Put them in a little backpack. Yeah.
One thing, you know, that's interesting about Streb in particular is, you know, she is very contemporary. I don't know if contemporary is the right word, but she's a very non-traditional style of dance. And kind of like you said, like if you're a circus performer and you look at it, you go, well, that's not really circus. That's something closer to dance. And if you're a dancer, you're like, oh my God, that's acrobatic and circus. And yep. It's so different. I'm wondering if either seeing her or being just so closely associated with her artistic development or just having a career where you see this very traditional style with your family in Vargas come all the way to now where people use words like contemporary and it's trying to be like more avant-garde or any of these things. If your own like tastes changed over time, or if you were ever like, I want to try doing something that's, you know, you talked a little bit a moment ago about how the artistic importance of the entertainment element. And was that always obvious to you? Or did you ever have like longing for, oh, I wish the circus was treated like theater or like opera or like dance where it's prestigious and has meaning and is in a fancy venue? Like, was there any, did you have that any kind of, I don't know, thoughts on that in general?
Yeah. You know, I had over the years had many different thoughts about like what place we have in the world, in the world of entertainment, especially. And we were always, my family, we were always trying to innovate. Whatever we did, we wanted to. This is why I this conversation is about, do you call yourself a circus performer or a circus artist? And I said, no, we're a circus artist, because in my view, you know, we're like painters, right? Painters, they all paint, but they each one has their own style, their own way. Yeah, I do flying trapeze, but I did it my own way. I did Wheel of Death, but I made it my, so that makes me an artist, because now I'm sort of recreating something in my own version and putting my own, you know, creation or taste. And but I was always very interested in all of that. And that's probably why I'm see myself like slowly I've been who I had become and the things that I've done, you know, just even with my own family and even with collaboration with Elizabeth Streps and other companies. I'm very anxious to see more of what we are. One conversation I had with Elizabeth Streb when she was opening the studio there, I said, you know, and you know, I could be very wrong about this, but it's just something that a conversation that, you know, whenever I always say it, I know we're, you know, people see us as circus because we come, because we perform in circuses, because we're from generation in circus. I'm trying to put this in the right way, where we are, I feel like we're artists first, okay, with our physical abilities and everything, our ideas. And we happen to be performing in a circus because the circus used to bring things, you know, even going back to the days of ringing, they used to bring even the bizarre or the most amazing or the most incredible, or the most, and I think, you know, before we are circus, we are artists in our own, even if we're born and raised or not, because we like to take our ideas and make it, you know, make it into something that's going to bring either joy or it's going to bring a wow factor or laugh. So I think that the circus, I'm just trying to, you know, put it in the right perspective. The circus, it is evolving, obviously. It's been evolving. It's always been evolving. There's been a holdback, I think, for different reasons. But it does need to be in a better place. I do feel that way. Because, you know, somebody said the circus was the mother of entertainment before theater, before TV, before it was already circus back in the Roman days. You know, so we should be out there with all of that. For why we're not, I don't know. But look, I'm happy. I'm very happy. I feel so grateful that I'm able to perform with my wife and kids next to me. That to me, that's the ultimate gift, you know, that because I'm a very family person. Now, that's how I grew up with my mom and dad and my siblings. Now I get to do that. And I enjoyed it. And I'm still enjoying it a lot. And I get to see my son putting, every time he finishes acts, he comes to me and he asks me, well, how was it? I said, okay, that was great. And, but you know, you can add this. You know, that's our life. And I'm happy with that. But I do feel that as an industry, we could be in a better place. I do feel that way because we have so much to offer, not mm-hmm. just the joy that we bring to people and the experience that, you know, they live when they come see our shows, but also as an example, you know, of how families should or can be, you know. I think we have a very valuable in family. I think we could use more of that in the world. Mm.
This summer when we did our circus show with Ottavio and Naomi, we had our baby on site and it was just like so amazing because in theater you don't really have the babies around, you know. Yeah. And it was so overwhelming and also like so nice to have it. And you know, the like Elsie and Serenity from NECA, they were like, it's so nice to have babies back on site, and it really feels like a circus, and it is something that seems very special to circus. And with circuses going into theaters, it's something that maybe is getting lost, of this like magic that is like this culture of this family generational thing. So it's interesting to see kind of where it's shifting.
Well, when we spoke to, I got to get her name, Dolly Jacobs, probably yep. this time last year, you know, she talked about how circus fit into the folk art, folk life festival at the Smithsonian. And part of the reason is because like the way the folk definition they use for folk art is that it's passed down from generation to generation, which also has an inherent family element. But I guess this is maybe a good opportunity to ask you what your advice for us might be as circus parents, like whether you have your kids on tour with you, anything you think is a good piece of wisdom, whether it's to do with traveling or teaching them or you getting your own work done, what can you share with us that that might be helpful?
Well, first thing I would say is like, you know, don't like include them into your life. Like, don't, you know, you it's not, oh, we have a baby, now we can do this and we can do that. We didn't do that because that's the way my parents did it and they were successful with. Just bring him into the, here's the thing though, like in the circus, because everybody who's they're used to having kids around, sometimes you go, hey, I got to do finale. Could you watch them? You go really quick, you come back. People are used to that. So, I mean, I don't know if you can do that in other industries, but in the circus, so that makes it more possible. Everybody else that understands and they, you know, where are you going to go? You know, if you're going to travel the way you travel in the circus, you know, and you're going to leave your family behind, well, then don't have a family because, you know, that's not going to work. You got to be with you. That's, you know, that's for me, my kids, my daughter. There's, you know, my daughter's 24. She's happy to make choices. She wants to be with us. Even on our day off, sometimes I want to take a little break. Like, can we go to the movies? Okay, you know, they're so used to being involved. And I love that. If the long as they want us around, we're going to be around because I want them around. That's, you know, that's our love. But yeah, I would just say that, you know, you have to just, they got to be, they're part of your work. They're part of your life. And what better place than in the circus? Because it's sort of a costume. You know, if you guys if you happen to be working together and we're touring somewhere and you need used to watch your baby for, you know, for a few minutes, of course, you know, as long as you trust us, we're fine. You know, so that helps a lot. It's having the right people around you that are used to that. And then teaching them the art. So I met some people that say, well, it's, you know, it's whatever they, I don't want to teach them anything because it's whatever they want to do. But see, my dad didn't ask me what I wanted to do. He taught me what he knew. And I'm glad that he did, you know, because what kid at 5, 6, 7, 8 years old really knows what they want to do in life? So, I mean, do you ask him to go to school? No, they got to learn, right? So I feel like we need to teach them as a, you know, as a tradition, we teach them what we know, you know, and then they learn it. And if, then in the future, when they're old enough to decide that they don't want to do it, then is the right time. But I think when they're kids is the best time to influence them. To learn something. Anyway, it's a good art. It's a good thing to do, you know, instead of getting in the laptop or whatever, which happens a lot. But I think that is, you know, we in Spanish we say inculcar, which I think it means influence, but in a different way. It's more like something you do and then you serve as an example.
It sounds similar to the word inculcate, which is to like to teach somebody like a method or a point of view. This is super random, but it's on this theme. Do you have recommendation for trailer, fifth wheel, or like bus? Like, what's the best way to tour with a family?
Well, here's the thing, though. I bought a motor when. Let me see. I had RVs years ago before I got married. Then we bring in brothers. We brought our own motorhome at one point. Then we live on the train for 4 years, which is great because you had nothing to worry about. Then we went to Korea for 1 year. That's where my daughter was born. Now I have my family, my wife and a little girl. So we came back and we were trying to do tours sometimes with like hand and foot, Shrine Circus, fairs, Six Flags, things like that, you know, very various stuff. And I said, you know what? It's more comfortable. I remember having a motorhome many years ago. So we're going to buy a motorhome. But because I perform the Globe of Death, these are very heavy equipment that I have to haul myself. So I needed a diesel pusher, which is a big engine motorhome. So the best thing, the best option at the time we had was $140,000 in a motorhome, in a diesel pusher, as they call them, because that was going to be comfortable with us. It had the slide outs and I could pull my heavy equipment. So I did that for like 7 years. That is the most comfortable because your kids are in the back. Your wife even can be cooking if you want, you know. The only problem is you don't have a car unless you pull. Yeah. Now, if you're pulling a trailer like I was, I had no car. If you're not pulling anything, then you can have a little car and then you can get around. So in that case, the fifth wheel or the trailer with the pickup is the good option. Now, the only problem is if somebody needs to go to the bathroom, you have to stop. Right. Unlike in the motorhome, because you can, unless you're the one that's driving. So there is the cons and pros and anything.
Yeah, okay, that's good. I feel like that's a good little bit of a few tips in there. Changing topic again, quite a little bit. What were you doing like in January and February of 2020, and how did COVID sort of affect your how the shutdown even like affect what was going on for you circus wise?
It affected us a lot because for the past. Since 2012, we've been doing business with this company here in Myrtle Beach called Spirit Productions, and they produce a lot of different shows. They do more singing, dancing shows, Broadway type of style shows. But they have one show, it's called Le Grand Cirque. And they've done this show, we've done with them. We've been to Australia with that show. I also own Big Top Tents. So they rented our tents a few times in their show there. In 2019, we did it here. Great, great spot. Good, you know, so this is a tourist town. we had the contract ready for 2020 to set up the tents again, but in a much more occupied area. So it was going to be a great, great deal for us performing because we perform, you know, be renting our tents and it all just like, It was one of the best deals I had, you know, for a while, and it just fell through. So we were stuck home, just practicing. We tried, you know, try to stay in shape. We came up with, I came up with this new idea. We call it Cernomics, which was like performers stuck at home, and I started doing videos. And I don't know, I just needed to stay busy. So we were there. We never been home that long, all the way up, because. We just came back from a trip from Europe, like I think in January. And then all the way up to August, we were like stuck home. And then we got an offer to go to Germany. But it was a theater, so we could only do, the kids were the only ones who wanted to perform, you know, each one of the two acts. So we're like, okay, well, let's go. We had family in Germany. My wife's family comes from Italy, but it's just, you ever heard of Circus Roncalli?
Sure.
Okay, the sister, her sister is married to the owner. So we visit that show a lot when we're in Europe. So anyway, point is that we were like, okay, let's go. So we're going to go work. It's called the Apollo Theater. We're going to work for 3 months there, starting in October all the way up to January. We got there and 2 weeks later, they stopped everything again. So we were stuck for another 2.5 months in Germany. The only good thing is that their food is very good there. So we were happy for that. And we visit the family 20 miles away. So yeah, so we were just like, all year was just a bad year until this year when we started talking to come back. But now a theater became available. So now instead of using our tents, we're performing in a theater. And, you know, it was still good. I mean, we're not using our tents, but at least we're performing all of our acts. But it, you know, it affected us, but I'll be honest, I was busy. We were practicing. We were doing the stuff that we do every day. Financially, obviously, everybody was affected. But, you know, what are you going to do? As long as you're healthy and you still have a chance to, you know, do it again, that's, I think, that was important. So we weren't like mentally hurt, just like, you know, we want to be out there performing and making money, obviously.
Right.
which is important.
I have a few questions. One, you may have already mentioned before I joined, but what does your daughter do?
My daughter, she performs hula hoops.
Hula hoops.
Yeah, she's very good. She's got a very unique way to present them. And she also does contortion, where she shoots a bow and arrow to the target.
I love that.
That was the one act. It's funny, Ines, just talking back about before, she didn't want to do hula hoops. I was like, no, I mean, you need to learn hula hoops. But I don't like it. I said, no, but no, trust me, you know, I had to push her for that. Now she loves them. Contortion, I told her, you know, my parents used to do hand balancing act. They used to do a trio with my oldest brother and my mom. And I remember my brother always saying how hard handstand acts are, you know, on your wrist and then, you know, it's the morning shows. And I said, you know, this is an act that you really have to be strong about to make sure you want to do it. She really wanted to do it. Well, she did it. You know, first 2 months I made her, you know, stuff out of Home Depot just so, to see if she was going to be serious about it. And sure, she, you know, she really wanted to do that. So that's, then I made her a really nice rigging, but she loves it. She's a good person too. You know, she's very, very good.
And what does your wife do? I know Naomi told me, but now I like am blanking.
My wife, her original act, and when I met her, we met in Ringling because the whole family came from Italy. Her brother is David Larrible, if you're familiar with the clown. And her and her brother, it's called the Washington trapeze or balancing trapeze, where she balances on her head and the trapeze. Mm-hmm. But her act is very unique because it doesn't just hang. It's actually on a motorized rigging that it goes up and down and then spins around as well. And while it's spinning in a 30-foot circle, she's standing on her head. So it's pretty crazy how much balance she has and how she's still doing it. She did it since you were little with her dad because her dad used to do that act.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. And then my other question was, so I know a bit about upkeep and the expenses and the hassle of a big chop tent, but as an owner of a few big chop tents that you rent out, what is the kind of obligation of basically owning the tents to rent out, and like how much is maintenance? Do you have to look at it all the time? Do you have to put them up and take them down, or like what's that whole kind of outlet like?
Yeah. Like I'm very used to, because my, you know, since I was a kid, my I'm very used to being around big tops, and we used to set them up. I was a little kid carrying a pole, maybe, you know, where they were taking it down. So I'm very used to, it's a lot of equipment. And we always own tents. Even I go back to the 80s, we took out a circus to the Caribbean islands when the whole family was together, and we bought a tent, an American tent here. And we had to transform it a little bit so we can fit the trapeze inside because it had too many poles. So we turn it into a less poles and then we can rig the trapeze. To me is the seating, the worst is the seating, you know, it's like a lot of boards, a lot of, Ottavio and Naomi actually helped us out to tear it down when they work with us. And they were like, oh my God, there's so much stuff. It's a lot of work. It's a big responsibility, obviously. And then when they're up, you gotta, you know, weather is always like, when my tents are up, I have the up always ready. Okay, you know, making sure that the weather is not going to get bad. There is always maintenance. Yes, there is an expense that comes with it, you know. But I think more than anything is the responsibility, you know, that, you know, you're going to set these things up. There's people going to go in there. Everything's got to be, you know, safe. I've done a lot of things. I even rigged for a while and ringing. For 2 years, they desperately needed riggers, and they give us an offer we couldn't refuse. My brother like, no, we want to have our days off. And they're like, it's only going to be 4 hours on the day off. And then you're like, anyway, we couldn't say no. So we came in and rigged. So we learned a lot of rigging. And I don't know. For me, it is a lot of stuff. It's a lot of, you know, things that you need to understand about tents and, but that's to me, you know, it's very, very normal. Mm-hmm. It's an expense. It's something you have to keep an eye on as well. The fabric, you know, you got to make sure that the fabric, you know, stays, like if water gets in there and let's say you have it in storage and it gets water, then it gets mold. And anyway, there's a lot of things like that. Then if you really like tent, you should own one, but if you're not, you shouldn't own one. but they're nice. They're beautiful, though. They're so
beautiful. They are. There's nothing like a big top tent, really.
No, it's not.
And this is a good transition. I believe that Omnium, which is a new circus, is using one of your tents this season. Is that the case?
So we were supposed to use one of my tents, but the area that we're going to play, they wanted, you know, it. Well, put it this way, it made more sense to have more capacity. Mm. So I end up outsourcing a bigger tent because my tent sends 1,000 seats. And the other tent is seats 1,700 seats, 1,700 and something. So we are going to be using a bigger tent instead of my tent.
So I'd like to hear about Omnium a little bit. I saw you were on the board, but on the topic of 1,000 versus 1,700 versus, like, say, Circus Mercus, which is 600 versus, I don't know, something very little is 200. Do you feel like there's a perfect... Is there like your favorite crowd size, given that, you know, with a tent you can go big or small? Is there anything you feel like is a really good ratio?
I'll be honest. You know, I think my tent is a 36-meter tent, which is about 118 feet round. And here's what I find out. Like, you know, we think, oh, bigger tents, better. In my mind, that was also the case. When I got married in... what year was that? 1996, I think. At the end of that year, we went to Europe and we visit the whole family from my wife's side. And Roncalli, which is in the circus, if you know circus, that's the most beautiful circus. And I seen pictures and I was like, oh, you know, well, we have to go visit your sister. And then I want to go see the tent. Well, that tent, it's only 36 meters. Again, it's only 118 feet, which is same size as what I have. And when I saw, I was like, you don't need nothing bigger than this. You know, almost like if you start to get too big, then it becomes too big.
Yeah.
And I think that was my realization. I think, you know, anything from, you know, 700 or even anything from 500 to 1,000 seats, it's great.
Yeah.
You know, even for business, if you do your numbers right, if you're selling tickets and you're going to do all that stuff, which we had a taste of that. And it's it can work. You don't need more. I mean, financially, I mean, you can always get more money, but it's,
you have to have the audience to get it. You know, well, that's the other thing. If the tent is full, it feels awesome. And then if the tent is huge and 2/3 full, it still feels empty because it's such a huge tent. And, like, you know, the audience size is such a, like, it's like, what do you want more? Is it the feeling of a packed tent that is going to make people be like, wow, this is such a fun experience? Or is it like the opportunity to make more money on more potential tickets that who knows if they'll be bought? But it's such an interesting.
No, I would stick to, you know, anywhere between 5 to 1,000 seats. It gives you a good show. Nobody's too far from, you know, and also know that the more people, you just said that, you know, everything's more contagious. The laugh is contagious. The reaction is so it's just, it feels better to have that tent packed than have it half full. Always is. That was my, you know, again, the reason we don't go away is because, you know, there's some budget that we need to, the potential of, right. I mean, hopefully we'll fill it every show. That's the plan. You know, I'm excited for that. It's another project that I got involved actually almost a year ago, you know, when Lisa Lewis, you know, approached me about it. So we want to do this and you have tents and you have access. I said, yeah, let's do it. You know, anything, you know, it evolved to become more and more of like bigger and bigger, which is great. But it's been so much work. It's been, we've been having meetings like nonstop, sometimes 5 a day.
Well, we'll definitely be in DC.
Are you guys performing in it?
Yes, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Awesome.
We're gonna have, we will perform in the wheel of death, which you like.
I do.
And then you'll see my wife performing and our kids as well. And we have other acts, and it's going to be a great show. I really, you know, it's another angle to the circus. You know, the circus is always, to me, at least in my experience, has always been inclusive in my view. Because, I mean, I work with so many nationalities and many different, you know, people. But I think the idea here is to, you know, what's the word? Promote it more, like feature. Say it. Yeah, mm-hmm. Just say it out there. Listen, this is what we're doing, and this is a good thing that everyone should be doing. Mm-hmm. And you know, just exposing it more and putting it out there. And you know, I wrote the show. I have, you know, there's some little bit of concept, not exactly storyline, but something that still keeps everybody, you know, following the show, along with all the excitement and the laughs and the wows of the audience. So it'll be a great, it's going to be a lot of work. It already is, but we still got a lot more work to do when we get there. Where are you guys located?
So we live in Brooklyn, right next to Barclays Center. Like we're about two blocks south of Barclays Center.
Okay. All right. So it's a few hours from you.
Hours. We're gonna do Big Apple. We're gonna do Omnium. We're gonna do the whole Winter Circus. There's another one called Empire Circus that's happening here in Dumbo. That's like in a bookstore that they're converting. It's definitely everything. And Cirque du Soleil has their Christmas show in the same window. So there's a lot of stuff to see between November and mid-January this year, which is good after a year of not having. I'll take a little overload.
It'll be fun. I think something that needs to happen in this country, which is something they do in Peru. We were over there once. It was like a summer, I think, for about 5 weeks, but it's longer. We were only performing for 5 weeks, but there is a time in the year when all the circuses come to Lima, Peru, and there's like 30 circuses, and the people in the circus say that they do okay in the year, but you know, because you would think here it's like, no, it's competition. You know that no, over there is when they actually do most of their business, because the people in the city, it's like a holiday. It's like circus holiday. Like they're gonna go see that show. They're gonna go see the Russian. They're gonna, and everyone is different. We did the horror circus that time, and it was a circus, but it was a horror. You know, it was a different concept. So I think something like this in the U.S. would be. I mean. It's going to take some time to educate the city that, you know, hey, it's okay. You can watch more than one circus in a month. But I think it will be so good for the industry if something like that can actually happen.
Yes. We've talked a lot about on the podcast how America as a country is much more regional, I think, when it comes to circus than national, with like a country like Switzerland or France being like the obvious examples of like, you can easily go 20 miles and have a new audience, while in the US you go 20 miles and you're still in the same town, which is like quite a big difference to touring. But I mean, Frank, I would love to see a circus. I would be in attendance of that festival for sure.
I'm really excited to see Omnium. I think it's also interesting to see kind of once, this quote unquote traditional, Josh and I don't totally love the definitions and putting things in boxes, but this traditional era of circus that kind of faded away around all the same time, and then is coming back, and then it's coming back in different ownerships, which is really going to be exciting and interesting, like with Big Apple going to the Willendas and Omnium kind of having a Big Apple feel, but totally new. And I think Empire Circus
du Soleil has new ownership.
Yeah, Cirque du Soleil with the new ownership. So I think it's going to be super interesting to kind of see like what's kept from the old, what's new, if the new works, or if people just like want to also have the nostalgia of what was.
We can have it all. I think they can all pre-exist, you know, coexist. Sorry, it's where like you can have a traditional for those who like. It's like movies. You like horror. There's movies, but then there's horror, there's love stories. And I think the circus can have that variety too. We can all, you have an idea, oh, I want to do a circus, which includes acrobats and aerialists, but I'm going to make it with this concept. I'm going to do this. And that's already happening. As long as this is all fine, as long as the audience digs it, they can dig it. Like I always say that Picasso was a very lucky painter, because his stuff was really strange, and he did it because he that's what he wanted to do. He was just lucky enough that there was a lot of people thought it was, wow, that's good. I like that. you know, as an entertainer, our job is really to do something that the audience likes. I know as an artist too, and it's got to be something it borns. I've done a lot of things that I feel, oh, I want to do this because that's what I want to do. And sometimes it works, sometimes it didn't work. But I think it, for me now, more or less, like I gotta, even though I have an artistic mind, or I think I gotta ask the question, is the audience gonna like it? Because if they don't come, then we can't exist. You know, we need to entertain, and that becomes a priority nowadays.
I think to a certain degree, definitely in America, like the audience will exist for a while. I know we talked about it a bunch, but the show we did this summer, no track record, basically. You know, it's from zero as far as like, have people seen this circus company before? And we had like 300 to 600 people a show in random towns where we spent $1,000 in advertising, nothing, you know? And it just proves that people see the word circus, and there's demand for something in that genre just naturally that exists. And it's my opinion that it's very underserved at the moment, as opposed to saturated.
I think that if the circus is done well, it does its job to give, you know, people come for a couple hours or an hour, whatever the length of the show is. And if they walk away with emotions, like they saw, because, you know, the circus have to have variety, because that's why it's a circus. You got to have the funny stuff. You got to have the thrill stuff. You have to have even the beautiful moment. You know, there's the horrifying moment. And all of those, you know, you need to go away like, oh my God, you know, I just went through all these emotions. And I think if you do a show that you give within those times and slots, those different emotions, you do a good job, and people will keep coming because they'll remember. Oh, they won't remember specific things, but they'll remember what they felt, you know? And I think that's going to be key to anybody who produces shows. And if you throw too much of the same thing, then it might get monotonous or redundant. You know, it's like too much of it. You got to vary it. It's like food, maybe. You got to put just enough of everything so it tastes good.
Yes. Cooking's a good analogy for sure. Well, maybe on that note, I'd love to ask you the same final three questions that we've asked every guest we've had on the show. The first question being, was there a piece of advice, either really good or really bad, that somebody gave you and that you remember or stuck with you?
A hard question. All for me, it is. You know, a lot of the stuff that I learned was from my dad, like flying trapeze. I mean, the best thing he did for me was, seriously, there were times when he wanted, like I wanted, there was going to be a barbecue in Circus Vargas, and everybody was going to get together and say, hey, Dad, can we like, because we could only practice at night. So he would be like, I said, Dad, can I go to the barbecue and like not practice tonight? He goes, nope. And I was so mad. I was like, but you know, and I'm glad he did that. So he, you know, thanks to his consistency and his old fashioned way of like, nope, practice first, you know, this is, and he gave me a career, you know, for us, I think in circus, at least, you know, college, it's our backyard or in the ring, we're learning the work that is going to make us money by, you know, learning the art. So that is, to me, I think the best thing my dad could have done for me is make me practice, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's,
I think, know, having instilling discipline, particularly for training, is like the, maybe one of the most important things for being a circus artist. Like we, on the show, we have this girl, Delaney Bayless, who's a female juggler who, the juggling community voted her number one last year of the top 40 jugglers. And part of the reason why she's so good is because every single day without fail, she practices for, you know, X amount of hours, you know, and the only way you get to that is with, is skipping the barbecue and going and juggling, you know?
For sure, for sure. Yeah, it's, you know, this art is, it's hard, it's painful, it's everything, all of them, like everything else, I guess. But you do have to, like, really, you know, and I don't know if it means like some people say, oh, you have to love it. Maybe you don't even have to love it. You got to know it's good for you.
Yeah.
If, you know, if that's, if you want to, if you're going to go somewhere, like, you know, I remember performing in Tivoli Gardens in Denmark and being in the French Trapeze and just being like, wow, you guys are amazing. And then Monte Carlo, we won the Silver Clown. We did, I mean, we've done all these jobs. I'd even forget sometimes of it. And I'm like, well, that's thanks to all that effort. You know, that's the payback right there. When you, you know, when you feel like, no, that's it. I don't want to do this anymore. This harder. Think of what you're going to miss, because it's just, it is up to you how far you want to reach with this.
When Josh and I just started dating, he was, you know, it's like 9 years ago now. He was like, if you want to get into the circus and be interested by it and produce it, you have to understand how hard it is and how much work it is. And I was like, okay. And he made me do a swinging trapeze class.
Flying
trapeze, but at Circus Warehouse. And it was, I was so bad at it, but it was so scary. Like the height, getting on the bar, doing it, and it hurt. And
took her hands.
My hands hurt, you know. But it was good because I really appreciated all of the time and effort that it takes to be at a certain level. And I think that was a really good lesson for me, because it was like, wow, this is hard, and you have to devote your life to it.
Well, I think, you know, those lessons, like the whole anything you do in circus, they go beyond your physical lessons. I think it does give you a sense of, you know, I don't know, like secure, like, not secure. How do you say it? Like, just, you know, if you can do this, you can do anything.
Confidence.
Else. Yeah. Well,
confidence.
One thing you said in the beginning of the interview, talking up and far with my mic. One thing you said in the beginning of the interview was how if you just want something, you know, and you go for it, it'll happen, which I think is true. But I think probably the reason you believe that or you have that in your bones is because that is what circus proves. Mm-hmm. Circus proves you say, I'm going to do the triple. And then you work on it, or I'm going to juggle nine or whatever. And if you're determined, you know, and you practice, you will get it. And I think it's a very powerful metaphor for life, which is also why I think circus, like recreational circus for kids, is good, even if they never do it, because it teaches that lesson, basically, that if you want something, you can, and you're determined and you practice and you work on it, you can achieve it, which is maybe not a bad segue to the second of the three questions, which is there a piece of art, could be Picasso, or it could be a book, it could be a movie, it could be another show, that you just love and you would recommend to somebody to experience?
There was a time, there's many, many things I could recommend, but I do remember something. There's a book that my little girl stole when she was like 9 months old. And she, it would happen because my wife went shopping, and then when she came back to the car, she didn't realize she was holding a book.
They do that. They just grab stuff.
Yeah. They put it on the car, and it's like, oh no. And so anyway, she took the book back, and it was called, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. And it's all small stuff. And at the time I was really pushing hard to make this show that we were trying to put together, and I was stressing, and you know, it was one of those things like you set yourself that you're going to do it, and now you're going to finish it. And I remember that book, it was so simple and so plain. There were so many things in there that really we already know, we don't get reminded enough how things can be so simple. So I would say, you know, something I would say is like, there is certain books that I was a reader, but not too much. I used to read like stuff like The Prophet, like very deep stuff, you know, for a while, but you know, probably not very useful sometimes. But this book, I remember like, okay, you know what? Sometimes we got to read stuff that we don't even think it becomes useful. It gives you a little sense of perspective, and you're like, you know what? That's true. And then there's actually like more than one book, Richard, I forgot his author name. He did Don't Sweat the Small Stuff with Family, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff with Business. He did like a bunch of versions. I didn't read them all. But yeah, I think books are very helpful. You know, not just books, you know, a book that's going to give you, that would be my advice, that I watch movies that inspire me a lot of, like Trapeze, obviously. That's everybody, yeah. Every Trapeze person inspire me. When I actually visit Paris and I saw the, I was standing like, oh my God, I was a kid. Now I'm here, you know? It's, I have to say this though, and maybe this is what I said in the beginning. I feel like I'm proof that when you wish something, you get it. There's a lot of things that happen in my life that I honestly didn't think they were ever going to happen. They were just dreams. They were just like big hopes and big dreams. And as time went by, and now that I'm in my 50s, I'm like, you know what? I did that. I remember wishing for that. And that happened to me. And that happened to me. And everything that I wish for in my life, it happened to me. And I can only feel grateful to that because, you know, you don't think about it. Because you know the years, it takes a long time, but it's so important to always be wishful and always be very optimistic and stay optimistic, and be a big dreamer. Like, hey, why not? You know, like don't be afraid to dream big. It's, you know, if it doesn't happen, hey, at least you enjoy the, you know, the dream.
Yeah. But it does. Who else will? Right.
Yes. So I would say, you know, just, you know, keep things exciting, keep it, stay passionate. I mean, this, anybody can tell you that, but that's been my formula. And I've been a very, you know, happily, you know, I'll say successful within the circus. You know, I've done a lot of things that I'm proud of. I've been to a lot of places that I wanted to be, and it feels good. What can I say?
Awesome.
Well, our final question is, who do you think we should have on our podcast?
Who? Oh, I didn't think about that. I can't think of right now on top of my head, but I will give you my advice. Can I email you and tell you? I can't think of it because I don't want.
Yeah, you can email us. Anybody who you think would be just an interesting person in the circus to interview.
Yes.
That's basically the prompt.
Any realm of circus too. It doesn't have to be a performer or, you know, just anyone.
Yes. Definitely. You know, what you guys are doing is it's great. I think it's, what happened to circus, I think it hasn't been in the past, hasn't been documented enough. It hasn't been portrayed out there as much. You know, I think this is the new era for circus, you know, especially with communications like this. I think I think it's a window to see more of who we are, even within ourselves. Cause I know a lot of people probably that you interview, but I don't know them in depth. You know, I know who they are, I probably met them. And so I think this is great. You know, this is a good example for, I think.
Well, it's nice to go from reading a bio and then diving into it, you know, and diving into like how you became who you are. And that's really what is so special. And also like what we don't want to lose. Like there's so many amazing artists that we've already lost. And I think my fear is that we don't talk to someone that's important and then we never get the opportunity to like record their story. So that's
it's a great, you know, something that stays, you know, forever for history. I think I sent you a bio. I've done numerous of things, but I even within the circus, like when I was in Ringling, I used to do what they call the end of the year video. I used to film the whole year. And did clips and people, that was like the thing at the end of the year. I mean, I was always very anxious to do different, you know, whether it's make a new act or a new show or designing a new rigging. Have you seen Elizabeth Strep's newest rotating, we call it the Molinete?
It's I have to look. I follow her on Instagram, so I'm sure I've seen it on social media.
It's what three people spin around.
Yes, okay,
That was my mom's act. She used to do that single. She used to do that also as a single person. And the conversation that led with Elizabeth Strep, I said, you know, my mom used to do that. Maybe I can design one with three people. And it took years to come up with
that's
the full
so
idea
cool.
And coming up, you know, with the funding. But that's another rigging that I designed for her. And then I brought it up to New York and I said, okay, here it is. Now play with it. This is what you need to know. But I mean, I'm just always like to do things, anything to do with circus acrobatics. And so I'm I'm more of a doer than a talker, to be honest, because I don't know how good I did in your interview, but
this was fantastic. Oh, we loved it. You did great.
Yeah,
you did wonderful.
We probably could have kept going for another hour, but you know, have to be conscious of your time. But one more question. Do you weld all the stuff yourself when you like for the Wheel of Death and when you create a new design? Do you do all the welding?
I used to weld, but I stopped welding because then I became more of my youngest brother. When we started building stuff ourselves, I became more of the designer, cutting, measuring. And then so I stopped welding. So now when I have something that I have to have done, I just take it to a shop and have it welded. But I don't weld anymore.
You need to have like six siblings because you have the sibling you do your act with. You have the sibling who welds your stuff. You have the, you know, that's the importance of a big family. Well, Noe, thank you again. This is such a pleasure.
I know. We can't wait to come see Omnium.
Yes, it'd be great to meet you in person. So yeah, come on down.
Yeah, because it starts exciting. November, right?
It starts in November 18 and runs November. Till the January the 9th.
Amazing. We'll We're going to bring our son.
He'll be great to meet you. Yes, please come bring him down. We'll give him a ride on the Wheel of Death.
And that was our interview with Noe España.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
And don't forget to get your tickets to Beyond Babel, now playing for 5 more weeks off-Broadway in New York City. Use code PODCAST for a secret little discount.
Have a good rest of your week.